When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show for Friday, June 23rd. Derek Van Riper here with Keith Law. On this episode, we're going to discuss several recent promotions, including Henry Davis getting the call to the Pirates, Gavin Williams getting a promotion from Cleveland, where Bo Naylor was also brought back into the fold as well. Emmett Sheehan has debuted since Keith and I last spoke, so we'll talk about how he fits into the Dodgers' rotation plans for the rest of this season. And time permitting, we'll get to a few of the big surprises of the first half, some unsung heroes, if you will. But let's begin with Henry Davis. As the Pirates are sinking in the NL Central, Henry Davis is at least a part of the big league roster, which I think is the kind of thing you have to do if you're Pittsburgh. The division's wide open. Why wouldn't you bring up anyone who's close to big league ready if you feel like you've got a chance for it? Interestingly, though, Keith, he debuted in right field. I didn't think they were going to make a move like that quite this fast. So how surprised were you to see the position switch for the big league debut of Henry Davis?
Medium surprised, I guess. Not incredibly surprised in that they've moved both him and Indy Rodriguez around. Bias Cat has thoughts, by the way. They've moved both Davis and Indy Rodriguez, who's also a natural catcher, around in the minors this year, and which I think was, at least at the time, I assumed that it was much more a function of just trying to make sure both guys got enough playing time. And if they both end up in the big leagues at the same time, which is likely, then, you know, you create some kind of job share, or maybe one of them moves off the position permanently. I don't think either guy needs to move off the position. There's been this narrative for a while that Davis just can't catch. And I knew some people, some scouts who saw him in college and thought he was pretty bad. But one, I don't think that's true. Two, I don't think that is remotely up to date with how Davis has been. If he ends up in another position, it's probably just going to be because Indy Rodriguez is a better catcher and they just want to get both bats in the lineup. And they're both athletic enough actually to play a couple of other positions. I know Indy Rodriguez has played first and done so extremely well. And Davis has bounced around to a couple of positions and it looks like he'll be able to stick maybe at several different spots.
They've got some flexibility with both of those players. I think it's nice if you have guys like this who can catch and do other things, because you can take wear and tear off their legs, not have as much responsibility on them behind the plate. So a good problem to have in Pittsburgh. I think the roster as a whole is starting to perform more in line with overall expectations. They were a fun story because it was so unexpected to see what they did earlier this season. But as you look up and down at the players they've got right now, even in this division, you think about the talent the Reds have promoted, you think about the injured players that Milwaukee will eventually get back, even a team like the Cubs, who they just saw this week, looks like it's got a better big league roster than the Pirates. And that is a bit of a problem. But can you say that this year, at least the first half of this year, has been successful in the overall rebuilding effort? Is that a fair statement? Because you have more than just big-time prospects arriving. You have some guys who are contributing that you didn't expect to get this much from. Mitch Keller is probably one of the biggest success stories in the big leagues this year.
Yeah, I would say so. I think Mitch Keller taking a step forward is, look, it's going to be essential if this club is going to be relevant anytime soon. They're going to have some of the pitchers who are already in the majors take steps forward for them. He has done so. I'm not the biggest Johan Oviedo supporter, but it looks like he could be a credible third, fourth starter, probably more fourth starter than third starter. I think they could use one or two more of those success stories. Like, we've been waiting for a while for Ke'Bryan Hayes to take that next step offensively, and that is absolutely not happening, unfortunately. So I think there's other things you can point to if you're a Pirates fan and saying, well, this is one thing that isn't going well or as well as we had hoped. But there's a pretty big wave of talent, double A, triple A, maybe not a ton of stars, but a lot of very useful big leaguers on its way to Pittsburgh right now.
Yeah, with Ke'Bryan Hayes, the lack of power is a little bit surprising to me, if only because he does hit the ball hard. He just doesn't hit the ball hard and lift it, and he doesn't really pull it that often either. So I don't know at this point if it's acceptable to just write off the possibility of a 15 to 20 home run season down the road, or if it just takes a new organization down the road or new hitting coaches or what it's going to be. But the ingredients are still there, even though we've got now basically two full seasons worth of big league plate appearances where it just hasn't happened yet.
Just has not happened. I mean, that's it, right? I'm not giving up on it because I think he can be a better player. And, you know, he is one of the remnants of the previous regime where they just did not have any success. In fact, I think they sort of preached against a lot of guys trying to pull the ball and trying to drive the ball. And you had a lot of players who came out of there who should have had more power and didn't. You know, Kevin Newman's an example I've given a lot, a guy I saw hit the ball harder in college than I ever saw him hit it in the big leagues. And he's having a tiny bit more success for Cincinnati this year. But I just think some of these guys they're never going to recover from years of being given a totally different hitting approach that has just, again, has just not worked out. And I'm glad that they're not preaching this anymore. We're seeing guys come out of that Pirate system, or even within the Pirate system, who are hitting the ball harder and who are going to end up hitting for more power once they get to the big leagues.
Let's move on to some other recent debuts, one in Cleveland that took place on Wednesday. Gavin Williams is up. So he is the third rookie pitcher, at least the third prospect to join this rotation. Tanner Bibee, Logan Allen already in the mix for the Guardians. What does Gavin Williams bring to the table?
It is an elite fastball. It's one of the best quality fastballs, certainly, in all of minor league baseball. I guess now in major league baseball, but it was in minor league baseball. And he lives and dies with the fastball. He's got a decent breaking ball, maybe better than decent, but it's not a wipeout pitch. And the real issue that he's had all the way up through the minors, and this was true even the early part of this year, is getting lefties out because he does not have a very effective third pitch. His changeup is like a BP fastball, and I don't think that's going to play. I do think ultimately he's going to have to find some kind of other weapon. I mean, maybe it's not, you know, ultimately, maybe it's not a changeup. Maybe it's try to give him a splitter. Some teams try a cutter with those guys. It's got to be something, though, because this has been a chronic issue for him. They see the ball too well, and he doesn't really have anything to keep them from hitting, really just hitting either of the two pitches that he does have. The fastball that they just get a better chance to gear up for, or the slider that's breaking in towards their bats.
Yeah, we saw a lot of that four-seamer in the debut. Threw it 54% of the time. We saw some sliders, changeups, and curveballs all mixed in, all less than 20% of the time each, though. So that go-to secondary, that's going to be something we'll have to keep an eye on with Gavin Williams. But this trio seems like it's going to give Cleveland the option of trading Shane Bieber if they want to. I think there have been a lot of conversations recently about Bieber maybe not bringing a lot back in a trade, and you might be better off keeping him simply because you still need five starters, even if you have three very good young ones. Unfortunately, the arm injuries this year for Tristan McKenzie they're concerning. Maybe from a long-term perspective as well, you hope for the best for him, but he may be down for a while as a result of his latest arm problem. So I could see the case for trying to stay in the race, trading Bieber, getting the bat that you need, but then you're putting a lot of pressure on the young guys and the depth guys if you do that, because even though Shane Bieber is not peak Shane Bieber right now, he's still a very valuable big league starter.
Yep, absolutely. I think it's a case where you don't trade him unless you really like what you're getting back. Right, you have to believe that you're getting back enough in return. And in their case, I'd probably be looking for position players because, as we've discussed quite a few times, this is a chronic issue for them, being unable to develop quality position players, particularly position players with some thump. It's been a really long time since they've done that. And yeah, I think that is a case where they need to be addressing this. They need to if they're not going to draft and develop those players, they need to go through the trade market to try to find those guys. And, you know, last year they did try to take a position player, probably not a big power guy, more of a pure hit guy, with their first pick in Chase DeLauter, who was coming off a broken foot and is actually still has not actually played a regular game in the minors. He has five rehab appearances so far in the Arizona Rookie League, almost a year after they drafted him. So whether he turns out to be a quality offensive player, still very much to be seen, but the timetable is certainly going to be much delayed from what they thought when they first drafted him.
Yeah, I still think the organizational flaw in Cleveland, just having guys that make contact but don't do damage, is so strange. And I wonder, are they trying to replicate success they've had in the past? You take Jose Ramirez as a guy that I don't think ever projected to be the kind of player he became. Francisco Lindor, I think, maybe even developed more power than some would have expected. If you do that a couple of times as an org, do you try to follow the same blueprint? These are different people in the front office. So I wouldn't think that's the case, but from the outside, sometimes that's what it looks like they're doing.
It's pretty clear that the Cleveland draft model, at the very least, has strongly emphasized contact over damage. That's fine if what you think is that you can improve damage, right? Mm-hmm. You can teach a guy either to lift the ball more, which has very much been the Dodgers' philosophy for quite a while now. It's Will Smith being one of their bigger success stories, but also guys, minor league free agents like Max Muncy and Chris Taylor, who they got in a very minor trade. That's fine. That is a player development philosophy, clearly. But they've also proven that they can do it. I don't think Cleveland has the success story to say, we're going to take those contact guys and then have them hit the ball harder or put the ball in the air more. And it's not producing the high contact approach by itself is not producing enough run scoring. This was the whole thing the end of last year when they made that run in the playoffs. You may not be familiar with how we play. I'm like, yeah. Right. And making a gesture that I probably can't describe on the podcast. Like, come on. Most of us are old enough to remember this. The reason teams don't do that very much anymore, because it doesn't work. You don't score enough runs that way. And at some point, they're going to have to develop a power hitter or go outside to find a power hitter.
It was a thumbs down gesture, in case you were wondering.
Yeah, really wasn't totally. A big deal. Absolutely what that was. Yeah.
Bo Naylor is back up. They did DFA Mike Zunino last week prior to bringing Bo Naylor back onto the roster. I just thought, given their needs as a lineup, they might have made a move like this sooner. Not necessarily getting rid of Zunino, but bringing Naylor into the equation to provide some pop from the left side. And he's a do-everything sort of catcher. We've talked about him before. Now that he's up, do you think it's reasonable to expect him to be up for good and to take over the bulk of the playing time behind the plate in Cleveland?
I certainly hope so, because I don't know what the heck the plan is otherwise. And DFAing Zunino, I think, makes it pretty clear they're going to give him a shot. I have to say, I really enjoyed when he got his first big league hit last night and the camera went right to his brother, who was like ecstatic, on the verge of tears. It was pretty awesome. Like, definitely here for more of that kind of content as well. And also, it was overdue. Poor Naylor, right? He got up last year. He got scattered playing time. He went 0 for 8. And then he was, God, what was he, like 0 for 10 or something this year at the time that he had the hit. So, yes, also just glad he's off the schneid, because I think he's a really good player. I think he's going to hit. He just kind of had a little rough luck to start his career.
Yeah, he did a great job really turning things around starting in Double-A in 2022 after a really disappointing run in Akron in the season coming off the pandemic. We wondered about that coming off of 2020, how many minor league players would just have a down year in 2021. It would just take them a while to knock the rust off. They could come back in 2022 and kind of regain all the prospect value they previously had. Bo Naylor definitely was one of those guys, but should be an exciting player and hopefully gives the Guardians a little bit more on the offensive side, because they desperately need it. As far as Bieber goes, just kind of bringing it back to him for a minute, the big issue, if you haven't looked closely at his numbers in a while, you haven't really seen him pitch much this year or anything like that, he's just not striking guys out the way he did earlier in his career. And when Bieber broke through in Cleveland, Keith, he wasn't really expected to be this guy that was going to pile up the 259 strikeouts that he showed us back in 2019. That was a level that I think very few people, if anyone, would have expected him to reach. It was always more of like, he's got great command, he's got a deep arsenal, he's going to get you a ton of innings, but it's probably more like mid-rotation stuff. And that's kind of the pitcher that he's quickly aged into, even though he's only 28. It's kind of surprising. It feels like Bieber's been around a lot longer than this.
Yeah, I didn't even think he was a mid-rotation guy, because the stuff was just lacking. It's like, yeah, this guy throws a ton of strikes, but you have to throw a little bit harder than that and have better quality to all of your pitches to make that successful. You know, the guy, if you throw 88, it's really, really hard to have any kind of big league role. And he was maybe 88, 91 when he was in college, at least, at the point when they drafted him. It also raises a question long term. You know, one, can he get back to where he was, right? But second is, what if the Cleveland approach to adding velocity comes with an expiration date, right? We just assume, oh, that's who these guys are forever. But what if it doesn't last all that long? What if it gets you 4 years? Everyone might say that's good enough. Hey, 4 years of throwing much harder than you did is better than 0 years. or, you know, not having a career at all. But it's pretty interesting if whatever it is they're doing, it's not actually harmful, but it does not last. And that would, does that change, one, how they approach doing whatever it is they're doing exactly with these players, but more importantly, how other teams look at them, look at these players in trade too. If you're looking at Bieber, or say that they tried to trade Bieber a year ago, but you knew there was this cliff coming for him, or, you know, whoever the next guy is like that, do you look at them and say, we're not getting that guy. We're not getting peak Shane Bieber. We're not getting peak, I don't know, Tanner Bibby's another guy who was, you know, he's gained a full grade or better of velocity since Cleveland drafted him. What if it only lasts a couple of years? Does that change the approach, and should that change Cleveland's approach going forward? There's a lot of questions I have. Bieber is N of one, right? This was the first really big example of them taking a command guy with a delivery they really liked and figuring he just needed to add velocity, and they were able to do so. But now the velocity's gone. He's actually, this year, his average fastball velocity is in the bottom 10% of all of baseball. That's a problem. And it's not to say he can't have any success, but he ain't the guy he used to be. There's a lot more. He's giving up harder contact. He will continue to give up harder contact. And he's just, I would have to assume, he's just not the guy he used to be. And if you're Cleveland, you put him out in trade, and maybe you have to adjust your expectations. Maybe that also leads you to just saying, we're just going to keep this guy no matter what.
Yeah, and you worry as he gets further into his career, if he loses another tick and a half on the fastball, which has happened. Going back to 2020, he's throwing 94.2. Sure. Back in 2020, lost almost a tick and a half going to 2021, lost another tick and a half, got down to 91.3 last year, and that's where he's been staying. He doesn't throw his fastball a ton, but it just changes the ceiling completely if you don't have that pitch working the way he used to have it. You have to be a lot more crafty. You have to rely so much more on secondaries, and that can be very problematic for a number of reasons. And it's a great point. I mean, the praise they're getting, it may not matter for the organization. Cleveland is one of those teams that chooses not to extend most of its players. If the shelf life is 4 years, other than other organizations understanding that and seeing it and not necessarily overpaying to acquire players from them, you're sort of like, well, not our problem anymore. This guy's a free agent. This guy's on someone else's roster. So it's kind of a cynical way of looking at it, but also could be part of the calculus there.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's talk about the Dodgers for a bit. Emmett Sheehan debuted last week. Pretty big riser in season this year for a lot of folks. Pitched really well at Double A, Keith. And similar question to what I asked you about Williams. What does Emmett Sheehan bring to the table? And a semi-related question, how surprised are you to have seen him in the first half of this season in the Dodgers rotation?
Yeah, I really didn't think we would see him. I mean, it speaks to the Dodgers' catastrophe, right, in their rotation this year. Coming into the year, the Dodgers thought he was a starter. They were continuing to develop him as a starter. And I don't know a single scout who doesn't like Sheehan, but a lot more guys were saying it's probably still a bullpen arm at the end of the day. And I mean, this is another guy who was, I think, 89-92 for BC when the Dodgers drafted him. And literally within weeks of the draft and him signing, he was suddenly 96 to 98 or 95 to 98, something like that. I mean, of all the Dodgers' ridiculous success stories, that might be the most ridiculous that I've heard, like for somebody to get that much better that quickly. He didn't have great results at BC. And of course, he's had great results wherever he's pitched so far in the minors. And the fastball appears to really, really play. I don't know about the command. Obviously, we'll have to see him go around the league a little bit more, but in some role, I think it's fair to say Sheehan will help the Dodgers for the rest of this year. If they choose to keep him up for the rest of this year, maybe it's not as a starter. Maybe it's a bulk guy. Maybe they tandem some starters just to try to get through. They are in a different situation here, right, where they never expected to be, and they're having to lean on guys they didn't expect to have to lean on in the first place. But I think Sheehan helps them in some role, and it goes back to Dodgers are one of the two or three best drafting teams in all of baseball. That's the same draft that got Nick Nastrini that year too, in the fourth round. He's going to end up impacting that club at some point. If not this year, then probably in the early, early part of next year.
We also saw one of their outfielders come up, Johnny DeLuca. And it's interesting too, that just with all the injuries they've dealt with, they've had to give some of their younger players, they've got a great system, we talk about that all the time, they've had to give guys opportunities sooner than expected. But a part of me wonders if they're doing this now to better understand what they want to do at the trade deadline, to sort of increase their understanding of how ready some of these guys really are for the big leagues, so they can hone in on the best possible upgrades at the deadline. Because they have multiple areas of need, and you can't necessarily fix everything mid-season.
No, no. Although they might, if any team has the prospects to do it, it's probably the Dodgers. It is. By the way, I just have to say, like, do you remember who played Johnny DeLuca in Goodfellas? Come on, that's not a real name, right? I'm Italian. I can make this joke.
Yeah,
it's every just, time.
It also messes with me because of Paul LaDuca. Like, it just doesn't work.
Right. Same guy, just with a fake mustache, Larry Hernandez.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yep. It is. And he's an actual prospect. He was 19th, I think, on my Dodgers list going into the season. But of course, the Dodgers are absolutely loaded. So that is certainly no insult to him at all. No, he's a legit prospect. And he's a guy, if you'd asked me before the season, I would have said, it's a guy they end up trading, right? That's got to be. And I think that, you know, again, another one. Did they ever actually think they were going to need Johnny DeLuca in the big leagues? He finished last year at AA, started last year in high A. But he's okay. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if he played competently enough in the outfield. I'm not going to give him an average for the rest of this year, even though he's 24, just because he's kind of inexperienced. But if he was below average, above replacement level for the rest of the season, wouldn't shock me. Got a power speed combination, has made more contact in pro ball than expected. He's just kind of been old for his levels, but the tools are actually there to support it. So I do think there's a chance at least that he could end up helping the club for the rest of the year if they had to. Once again, it's the Dodgers being in this position in the first place. And maybe it just ends up that DeLuca's up for 2 or 3 weeks. They pair what he does in the big leagues with very positive scouting reports from scouts who actually saw him, once you take the age out of the equation, and he ends up in a trade for them in July, because they have a lot of guys like that who would play for another club and just aren't going to be able to play for them.
Yeah. Maybe a fourth outfielder plus for them, kind of playing in the Trace Thompson role right now. James Outman, after that ridiculous start in the first month of the season, he's going through the adjustment phase. I think that's a kind way to put it. Mm-hmm. The Dodgers' problem is not scoring runs, though. They still have Mookie. They still have Freddie Freeman. They still have Will Smith. JD Martinez is having a nice year. It's the depth being a little less than what we're accustomed to, right? And part of that, I think, is Miguel Vargas had that thumb injury back in the spring. I've wondered if he's just been dealing with that all year. Max Muncy's down in the IL right now after a fast start. He kind of looks like a guy that's not aging particularly well. The power's there, but it's like, what else is in that offensive profile at age 32? David Peralta looks pretty old at this point, because he is pretty old at this point. So
he is in baseball terms, right?
He's actually old. He's been through a lot. It's a great story. I mean, he blew out as a pitcher and came back as a position player and carved out a much longer career than probably
really career.
Anybody would have expected when that journey began.
Right. You just have to be a realist, right? You're looking at this, I just pulled them up, right? Miguel Rojas, 34, not productive at the plate. Muncy, 32. Not too productive at the plate, really down, you know, it's basically walks and homers right now. It's not a great formula. If he's your eighth best hitter, seventh best hitter, you're fine. But Outman, like you said, not older, but he's obviously cooled off substantially. Peralta, 35, and hitting like it. JD Martinez, 35. It is all or nothing, right? It's either he's hitting the ball extremely hard for extra bases, but he's also making it out 70% of the time. Like, it's tough. This is not a great. Oh, and Chris Taylor is, I mean, he might be done. He's closing in on Dunn. He is in the same neighborhood as Dunn.
Yeah, Dunn adjacent. I didn't think Taylor was going to age as poorly as he has. There's been a lot of swing and miss in his profile. I guess that's part of it, is that he's, even when he was good in 2018, 2019, those were high strikeout rates. Maybe that was more problematic than I realized at the time. But when he started barreling the ball as much as he did 2020 going forward, I thought, all right, this makes sense. This is going to work. He sold out for the extra power, but he's getting to it enough where this works, especially for a guy that can play all over the place. And I've been surprised at just how bad he has been, really going back through all of last season, too. This is not a new problem for them. But I think there's a lot of things to take comfort in if you're the Dodgers. Even though the NL West standings, as we talked about on the Thursday show, they look a little strange right now. You've got everything you need to go out and address whichever problems you want to address, but there are more leaks than you'd expect. So if you were going to pick three spots on this roster, what would your priorities be? What are the most important things to fix if you're the Dodgers?
I'd probably look, if they can find an impact starter, right? Or even a close to impact starter, that's clearly what they need, but that's what everybody needs. You know, also if they get some, Julio Urías coming back healthy is probably better than any addition they're going to make at the trade deadline this year. So, I say that recognizing they might say, well, we're hoping to get one of this group of players back and we don't go get an impact starter who may not be available in the first place. So acknowledging that, though, with a left fielder who gets on base, a little bit of thump, that seems like the lowest hanging fruit. Rather than saying what I think is the top priority for them, I'm thinking what can they address somewhat easily. That might be the best option for them, because the problem they do run into with Muncy, say that Muncy comes back healthy, is he's not awful, right? It is not great. It's certainly not what they've gotten from him in recent years, but he's not terrible. Would you bench Vargas? Would you bench Outman because they're not playing up to expectations? We also want to play those guys so they continue to improve and make adjustments, or so you see what you have. It's a tough call when you're constantly contending, or like this year when you are not contending to the extent that you were expected to.
A lot has changed in the NL West from just last year to this year, and a couple of things have gone wrong for the Dodgers so far. And with all that, they're still in a good spot, even though it's going to be a much tighter battle for them trying to work through that division or end up in the wild card. I mean, that's one of the outcomes for them as well. I would be surprised if they didn't add at least one impact position player, even though the lineup isn't the problem. You see too many holes in that lineup when you get to the bottom half. Like, if you could find a way to get through the top half of the order, the bottom half is not much of a concern right now. And that's just something that we're not used to seeing. And I don't know if there's going to be a blockbuster sort of deal where they can get a controllable starter. Maybe that's their angle, because everybody else that needs pitching is going to be fighting over guys like Lucas Giolito, right? The pending free agents that seem certain to move.
He's the most obvious choice for the Dodgers, right? I mean, it doesn't matter. You don't get extra points because he's an LA kid. But if you're the Dodgers, aren't you thinking, like, this guy grew up here, right? This is a no-brainer.
If you're the White Sox and you want to max out on the talent return for a player like that, the Dodgers seem like a great team to call.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, honestly, that could be the fit of the year in terms of where you want to trade the guy. The team that most, or one of the teams that most needs the guy should have the greatest interest. The White Sox have a whole host of things they need to address right now. Their system is a mess, right? Their one really good prospect coming into the year, I think, is just now Colson Montgomery, had a not insignificant back issue and is just now coming back on rehab. And I don't know if we've got to change our assessments of him. Like, is this a back injury that's going to affect him going forward? But it's enough that combine that and some of the non-development at the major league level, like, they need to hit a home run. I hate using that expression discussing baseball, obviously, but yeah, they can't screw this up. And anybody else they're trading right now, they need to really nail a couple of these trades. Because it's a chance to remake the franchise. And if they don't, it's going to be a really long, ugly rebuild on the South Side.
I started to scratch the surface of this a little bit on the Thursday episode, but we're getting further away from the Matt Chapman and Matt Olson trades for the A's, and we're beginning to see just how poor those returns really are. I mean, sometimes time helps. When you go the volume route and you get three or four players back and you don't necessarily get elite guys, a year passes and you get a chance to put someone in your org and you make some changes and suddenly, hey, okay, this trade doesn't look as bad as it did. I would say the opposite has happened with some of the A's trades. And I think your point's a really good one with the White Sox. This is your best chance to fix your organization. It's going to take a long time to draft and develop the talent you need to be a really good team again. But if you can get the trades right, and it probably goes far beyond Giolito, it goes down to, we've talked about this before, like, which core guys do you keep and which ones do you move? It's more players that you're going to trade away than players you're going to hold on that current roster. But that puts them in a really good position in a market where because so many teams have a path to either a division being in the Centrals or a wild card with more wild cards, you have more buyers. That's a good thing. So you can take advantage of that as being one of the few we're clearly selling sort of teams in a year like this.
Yep, I agree with all of that there. It's a good, the one thing I'll say, I don't love the fact that basically everybody gets a participation trophy in October, is that it's good to be a seller, right? Shame on you if you're a team selling a good player at the deadline, rental or otherwise, and you don't get a solid return, right? There is no excuse, because there are just never going to be as many sellers as buyers under this system. And, you know, it's a seller's, that makes it a seller's market, and you should have, you should be able to get a really good return, a really, you know, a, maybe it's not always a franchise altering return, but a return that you can go back and say, no, we got good value. We did well. One player, multiple players. These are players who really help our organization, and I'll be a part of, you know, the next great White Sox team or whatever franchise.
I'm right there with you. I think that's a great way to put it. Let's talk about a few surprises from this first half. I saw Bryce Elder put up another great start on Thursday, and Elder's a puzzle to me. Every time he pitches, I see, I follow a lot of fantasy people, so I see a lot of tweets saying, this can't continue. And it's like, well, it's been a half a season. I realize anyone can surprise us for half a season, and you can kind of luck your way through a dozen or 15 starts, but how is Bryce Elder doing this? He's basically, by results, just stepped in and been Max Fried, even though he doesn't have the same stuff that Max Fried has. And that's, I mean, there's plenty that goes right in Atlanta right now. They've got a really well-built team. But Bryce Elder pitching like this is a huge and pleasant surprise.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to continue. I am definitely a bit of a skeptic. And I mean, God, you can even look at his, right? His FIP is a run and a quarter, I think, above where his ERA is. So yeah, I think he's going to regress. But I also think he's pretty clearly a capable major league starter. Maybe he's a three. He's certainly a good four. That is something they needed. The Atlanta's farm system is not strong because they've made so many trades, obviously. I'm not, this is not a criticism. They traded away a ton of good prospects to get good players. Not many of those prospects have kind of come back in some way to bite them. And on top of all of that, they last year, their approach was to go heavy on high school pitching, which I do think was a bit of a reflection of the draft class, but it means those guys are years away. So for someone like Elder, who was always a prospect, but it's like, yeah, he might be a fifth starter, to get to the big leagues. And turns out, I think a lot of this is just command, location has been better than expected. And that is something, I don't see any reason he can't continue to do that. That's why I think, okay, I said he was a fifth starter. Maybe now he's a four trending towards a three. I don't think he has the stuff to be more than that. He's not missing a ton of bats. He's gotten away with some weak contact, some luck on contact. I don't know that I really think that's going to persist going forward. But I do think he is a legitimate major league starter for them for the rest of the season.
Yeah, it's just so strange. You look at the individual pitches. The slider looks like it's a pretty good pitch. It's kind of like his best pitch. The changeup's not bad. And the four-seamer is one of those pitches I look at with Bryce Elder. I'm like, okay, so he must have a lot of extension. There must be something deceptive about it. And it's like, no, that doesn't really look like that's what's going on with him either. It's just, it just somehow has not been punished in a way where you'd expect it to. I don't know. A lot of sinkers too, so maybe he's getting good luck on sinkers, and that's a huge part of this too. Instead of being a four ERA guy, he's been a sub three guy because he's been fortunate with that offering. Not always the explanation people want.
They do catch the ball behind him. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, how much of that is great defense, how much of that is good luck, right? There's a lot of different possible ways that can be true.
Yeah, absolutely. Less surprising, because he was a free agent target who got a multi-year deal. Zach Eflin has been really good through 13 starts with the Rays. It's almost like the Rays know what they're doing. A 3.26 ERA so far, strikeout per inning. These are the best ratios of his career. And Zach Eflin, to me, the way you describe Bryce Elder is probably a way I would have once described Zach Eflin. Okay, yeah, back-end guy, kind of just okay. Philly's a tough place to pitch, so maybe the ratios were a little worse there than they would have been if he was in a neutral environment or a pitcher-friendly environment. Mm-hmm. But the Rays have done a lot to tweak him. His pitch shapes look different. There's a whole bunch of little things that add up to really create some big changes for Zach Eflin. And this has been huge for them in a year where Drew Rasmussen, another one of their acquired success stories that they were able to get a lot of mileage and great results from, he went down with an injury, which I think made Eflin staying healthy and pitching well, it made it even more important to them so far.
Yes, absolutely. It's funny because I remember when he signed, Phillies fans were quite critical of the fact that I liked the signing and thought he could be a good big league starter. And, you know, turns out he's okay. And maybe getting away from Philly was kind of exactly what he needed.
Yeah, I mean, changes, more cutters, more curveballs. So it's stuff that he had. Part of the appeal, I think, when you have a free agent pitcher like Eflin, a guy that has four or five pitches, you can change the usage, you can change grips, you can change things, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden the arsenal that was just kind of okay before can be a lot better. So I think the comp Eno made to him was Chris Bassett. I was like, yeah, that seems about right. Like, Chris Bassett became a little more interesting over time, but he's younger.
I got to say, I don't like that. I think Eflin's got better pure stuff. I think Bassett, you know, in terms of learning how to use your arsenal, certainly Bassett he's a good model for a lot of pitchers. But Eflin, God, I remember seeing Eflin in high school, which feels like an extremely long time ago, 2012, 11 years ago now. And it was 92, 96 with a really good changeup. But the question was, is he ever going to have enough of a breaking ball to be a quality big league starter? And I was, you know what, fastball changeup and, you know, maybe some, certainly for a high schooler who's got a really good changeup, I'm giving that guy a lot of opportunities to develop a better breaking ball. And as you said, he is really, you know, now it's a much different arsenal than it used to be. And that cutter, I think, has been a huge difference for him. And also his curveball is just more effective, certainly a better pitch than not only than it was in high school, but I think we had a reasonable reason to expect it to be when he was back in high school.
How often do you see players that you scout, you know, prior to the time they get drafted, have a really good secondary, their best pitch even in some cases? They have something that just vanishes by the time their pro career gets settled in. And I was thinking about it a little bit with Julio Teheran. We talked about it a couple weeks ago. It was all about the changeup for a long time with Julio Teheran, and it just kind of vanished like in the early part of his career. How often does that happen?
It's funny you bring it up because a huge question for folks who follow the MLB draft, and I had a mock-up earlier this week and I did a Q&A on Thursday to answer questions about it. And somebody even asked a little bit about this. Chase Dollander for Tennessee, as a sophomore, his slider was one of the best pitches in the country, and he just lost it this year. And everyone's wondering why, and there are a lot of rumors about what's happened. I mean, it's always possible he's hiding some sort of injury, but I have no information whatsoever to say he's actually hurt. Did he change his grip? Did someone else tell him to change his grip? Or is it just one of the more nebulous, well, he lost his feel, and he, you know, it's going to take time to get it back if he ever gets it back. There are reasons why a guy loses a pitch. There's never a good reason, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I guess sometimes the one thing I'll say that is the most common is I can think of plenty of examples of guys who went to the surgeon's table for Tommy John and came back with less of a curveball. That's just a thing. Dylan Bundy would be a good one. Jay Groom, I think he goes by now. He's another one. Giolito, you mentioned, had a hammer curveball in high school. And it's never really been the same for him. He has a curveball, but he throws a lot more sliders and changeups now than he ever did because the curveball wasn't the knockout pitch once he returned. So, yeah, there's things like that. But for a guy like, but for a guy to lose his changeup always shocks me because that doesn't require, say, the same mobility in your elbow, for example. It's a feel pitch. And that's always kind of odd to me, where we think of pitchers getting older and more experienced, they should improve their feel. They certainly shouldn't lose feel for pitches. So how does that happen? Is it from disuse or trying to throw they had me throw a cutter and now I've lost my feel for my changeup? I mean, I'm not a pitcher. Maybe that makes sense. It's never a satisfying explanation to me when that happens, especially when it's a changeup of all pitches. If a guy loses a breaking ball, I can kind of understand it because of the, you know, wear and tear on your arm. But to lose a pitch like a changeup that's, you know, for Teheran was plus pitch, if not better. For Eflin, it was. You know, I thought it was at least a 6 when he was in high school, and you think it's going to get better, and he's still got a changeup and still a decent pitch, but it's not the knockout pitch it used to be.
Yeah, he throws it like 5% of the time now. It's just such a strange development in the long run to see that happen. But you're right. Mm-hmm. The reasons seem like they would never really be good. Like if I'm trying to think of the best reason you'd have is like, well, I developed other pitches that were just better. they taught me to throw two other things that are just better, so I got rid of it. Like, oh, okay. Yeah. I guess that's a satisfactory explanation.
I have seen that, and this is a bit, you know, it's a stupid reason, but the thing where, hey, we don't want you to throw your curveball anymore. We want you to throw your slider. We want you to throw a slider instead. Okay, I don't love that, but teams do that. And, you know, that might make a pitcher worse off in the end, but it's tough for a lot of pitchers, especially the younger pitchers, to say, no, I'm not giving up my best pitch. They do what they're told. You know, they do what they're told by the people who are ultimately paying them. And I do understand that. And that's a really tough situation for kids to be in, where if it's, you know, often it's just organizational philosophy. We favor sliders over curveballs, or we think pitchers who look like this should throw a slider rather than a curveball. So you could see that happen too. And then it's, you know, often that guy has to get to another organization to get back to it. And maybe he never does because it's been too long since he threw whatever that particular pitch was.
Got one more pitching surprise I want to ask you about. Tyler Wells in the Orioles rotation. He's actually being used like a regular starter every time out. Last year, they were a little careful with his workload, especially in the first half of the season. Lost a little bit of velo on his four-seamer, but a 3.22 ERA, a 0.89 whip, 88 Ks, and 86 and two-thirds innings. This is a lot of high-quality innings for a Baltimore team that, when people looked at them coming into the season, they said, is there enough pitching? Well, there still isn't, but Tyler Wells, other than a home run issue, is helping in a big way right now.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a 4.6 FIP, right? So there's a big difference here, and I think a lot of that is really driven by that home run rate, where I think that he's, you know, he has given up, yeah, that's what I thought, 18 homers allowed, 12 of them with the bases empty. Only two of them with runners in scoring position. I guess that doesn't matter. You're always in scoring position if someone hits a home run. But so there's two interpretations, right? This guy's extremely lucky. I still remember, this is dating myself here, James Baldwin with the White Sox had a year where he was super homer prone early in the year. I think he ended up making the All-Star team that year and then kind of fell apart in the second half because it was like, no, you're just homer prone, right? You just are. And you're not going to keep giving up solo home runs. That said, if Wells is pitching a little bit differently with men on versus with the bases empty? Is he, you know, more willing to attack guys in the zone with the bases empty and suffer the consequences? I'm skeptical. I don't really love that as an explanation. That seems more like an explanation to fit the facts rather than this is actually what's going on. But I will acknowledge the possibility also. I mean, I think Tyler Wells doing anything in the big leagues is amazing. He was a 15th round pick. I don't think he ever appeared on any of my prospect lists, and probably not anybody else's either. So good for him. This is awesome. I think it's really hard to be a guy who gives up a lot of home runs, but they're mostly solo. So it's fine. Like, I don't really think that's a thing. That is not a sustainable profile. But I think he's shown he could be a starter. Like, he could be absolutely be a, you know, fifth starter for a lot of teams going forward, even with the home run problem. And maybe he adds a little something at some point to just be a little bit less homer prone. He doesn't have to go a long way because he throws a ton of strikes, as you pointed out, and the numbers bear that out. And that profile can last a long time if you just keep the ball in the park a little more.
Yeah, he's got a cutter that's been giving up a ton of home runs so far. 7 homers allowed by that pitch. He throws it just less than 20% of the time. I think
maybe don't do that.
The way you get away with giving up homers is just not walking a lot of guys. That's sort of the cheat code to, well, he gives up homers, but he's got a low walk rate. That's Tyler Wells, right? And the way you get away with some walks is that you don't give up homers.
Right. There's no such thing as the guy who walks a lot of guys and gives up a lot of homers.
Those guys don't stick around long. They get sent down.
They're in AAA, right? Yeah, that's not a thing, right? Because then, so, you know, it's just, I mean, not to be Captain Obvious, those aren't solo home runs so much.
Right.
Right. There's just always traffic on the bases. So, no, I think that's true. And I mean, that is there. It's a little bit of an older profile of a starter, right? A real strike thrower, you know, that's the guy who works quickly, pitches to contact, not afraid to throw strikes. There's nothing wrong with any of that. You just have to not give up too much damage when you're working in the zone. And I think that's where Wells is just on the wrong side of the line right now. But I want to rule out the possibility that he, Orioles, will help him find a way to just be a little bit less homer prone. Like, it's not that much, right? If this, he's given up 18 homers this year, it's a home run every other start or something fewer. And we're probably having a somewhat different conversation. It's not a huge adjustment to make. It's not easy, but I'm saying it is within reach. And you kind of want to see that because he does all the other things you want a starter to do. He misses enough bats. He throws a ton of strikes. It looks like he's able to, you know, he's lost a tiny bit of velocity, a small amount of velocity. He looks like he's able to hold up as a starter. These are all good things. There's just one last hurdle for him to establish himself as more than just a fifth starter.
Right. If he's going to sustain anything that looks like these ratios over a longer period of time, that adjustment has to happen. A lot of balls in the air. It kind of backs up the home run profile. Projections yep. point to like a low fours ERA going forward. That makes sense. That's still valuable. That's a little better than league average right now. I think 4.3 is a league average ERA in this run environment. You'll take that, especially if you can get another 85 to 90 Heck innings yeah. from him over the course of the second half.
When your lineup scores a lot of runs.
Yeah.
Right? This is great. I mean, the Orioles are really, if they found a bunch of guys who were 90% of league average, right? That a rotation that just had that would probably still make them a contender.
That's the funny thing about, you know, what we've seen from teams in recent years in the playoffs is that you get to these guys. Jose Urquidy is like this for the Astros. Helps you get through the regular season when healthy, not healthy now. Mm-hmm. Gets to the postseason and kind of vanishes because you don't need all of your pitchers when you get right. to that part of the schedule. But you do need guys like that to get you through 162 games. So maybe that's kind of the way Tyler Wells' season would play out, too. If the Orioles are a playoff team, maybe he's their first starter out. They'd use him a little bit as a glue guy out of the bullpen to chew up an inning or two here or there. And people would say, mm-hmm. wait, he pitched so well in the regular season. Why aren't you using him? Well, like there are limitations, and we're seeing them. We are going to go on our way out the door. A reminder, you can get a subscription to The Athletic for $1 a month for the first year at athletic.com/baseball show. You can find Keith on Twitter at Keith Law. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. That's going to do it for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. We are back with you on Monday.